Should people be confident that you're willing to go against Bob if you think it's in the best interest of the state?
Absolutely. Look, I had some, without divulging privilege, I had some hard-fought conversations with Governor Inslee as his lawyer. That was my job.
You don't want to share any of them?
No. Well, I do, but okay. I can't.
Not a lot of Democrats have been walking into the fire lately.
Is this what it is? Fire?
You and it might be. It's going to be. No, it's not. Maybe you and Mark Mullett. So I give you some kudos.
He's a Democrat still?
Oh, what? Mark, did you hear that?
I like Mark. I'm just giving Mark time.
Well, I don't know. That might be a good reason to endorse Dave Reichert for Mark Mullett. I'm just trying to stack him up. So I'm going to play that for him. Introduce yourself to people who are not familiar with you.
My name is Nick Brown, running for Attorney General of the state of Washington. I grew up in Washington, started my legal career as an Army lawyer, serving all over the country, all over the world. Worked for the Department of Justice for many years, worked for Governor Inslee as his general counsel, worked in private practice for about 4 years, and then most recently was the U.S. Attorney for Western Washington.
This has seemed like a natural trajectory for you to run for AG. How long have you been planning that?
I don't know how natural it seems or not. I mean, certainly in hindsight, I think my background prepares me well for the opportunity. But my career has not really been a straight line. I never actually wanted to be a lawyer growing up. It's just kind of found my way into that and fell in love with doing the work. I started really seriously thinking about Attorney General. When I worked for Governor Inslee, I got a chance to work with A.G. Ferguson and his team and got to know that office well. But I never really envisioned running until really 2022 is when I think I kind of made the decision that this was something I wanted to pursue.
Yeah. So what do you see the job of the Attorney General being? Because I think there is some misinformation out there. You know, we on this show, we blame Bob Ferguson quite a bit for the crime crisis, which, yeah, you passed a Dave Reichert for governor sign on your way in. So you knew what you were entering.
I was looking for the Nick Brown for AG sign. I didn't see it.
Sorry. You could give us one. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. But, you know, I think there is some fairness in that. And then there is some reality that, you know, the AG doesn't deal inherently with crime, like street level crime. But we'll talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
And why I still think it's the AG's responsibility to message on it. But what do you see the job of AGs being?
Well, twofold principally. One, I think you're the lawyer for the people of the state of Washington. So we have the opportunity as the AG's office to advocate for people on consumer protection laws, on civil rights, on healthcare, environmental protection. There's that independent authority that comes with the office to be their advocate on cases that are in the public's interest, however you might want to define that. The biggest day-to-day job is being the lawyer for the state of Washington, for all of the state government entities, every agency that the public is familiar with, Department of Transportation, Commerce, what have you. They all have assistant AGs that report to the Attorney General and also serve their client agencies. So the vast majority of the actual casework on a day-to-day basis is in that second category of representing state government and being their advocate and trying to improve the provision of legal services there. So I view those roles as sort of the two principal roles. And then there's some policy advocacy that comes inherent with the role, but the big job is to represent the people and represent state government.
What do you do when those two big roles are in conflict, representing the people and representing the government? I can think of many cases that are an example of that. For instance, the disabled woman who there was an allegation she was abused under the care of the Department of Social and Health Services. So in that case, you have a vulnerable resident of the state of Washington, person in the state of Washington, and you have a government entity. So when you have conflict between what's maybe in the best interest of the people and in the best interest of state government, what's your role?
Well, it's not easy. It gets complicated, right? I think, you know, first and foremost, as a lawyer for state government and for the agencies there, you have to make sure that you're always defending their rights and being their advocate. And so you can never lose sight of your ethical obligation as a lawyer and a professional to represent your client to the best of their interest. When I think about advocating on behalf of the people, you know, we don't represent individual people. So we're not going to be, you know, bringing a case on behalf of Brandi Cruz or any other individual like you might as a private attorney. Mm-hmm. But you look for those macro level problems where you can advocate for people. You know, we within that agency do a lot of civil rights cases, right? So we see a school that's not providing language access services or disabled people are not finding access to a facility like they should. We can bring a case on behalf of that that issue and that series of issues that might present itself there. But those sometimes can be hard, right? If you are advocating for access to a state building or something, and you're recognizing that your state client maybe hasn't provided access in the way that they should, you have to navigate those carefully. It's a huge agency. You know, one of the misconceptions that people may not have is a recognition of how big of a law firm it now is. And so you have to sometimes divide up the agency, make sure that conflicts are being avoided, put up shields between teams of lawyers that are working on various issues. This is something that public law firms do all the time. And I know the AG's office does it as well. But it's not an easy issue to navigate.
Yeah. And this is going to become a theme of, I think, the conversation and some concerns people have with what the AG's office has become in their perception. But I guess what I mean by that question is, do you have an obligation to provide fullest capable legal counsel to a state agency that you see as the AG has done something wrong?
Well, yes. So first and foremost, your job as any lawyer is to represent that client zealously, whether that's a criminal case and defending someone, whether that's a private client, you know, defending their interests as a client. That is what the rules of professional conduct require of all lawyers, regardless of their practice. So you don't get to not defend them as aggressively or zealously just because you recognize that they may have done some harm. But I think one of the areas where the AG's office needs to continue to do work is also helping their client agencies reduce harm to begin with. You know, sometimes as lawyers, and I saw this when I worked for Governor Inslee and worked closely with the AG's office, but I've seen it in a lot of different contexts. Sometimes you can get so myopically focused on just winning this case. Mm-hmm. And when you are representing state government, you should also be thinking about how do we prevent or reduce the likelihood of this case happening to begin with? And lawyers are quite often in the right position or a better position to see common trends, through lines, reoccurring problems. You know, we think about all of the cases that we have now in state government in the torts division where we're defending state agencies against some claim by the public. And some of those problems are reoccurring. And so I want to make sure that the agency is focused on how do we reduce the harm from happening in the first place and improving best practices and training and, you know, changing whatever other structures we need to. So that is an important role to play. And I hope to bring that, you know, experience and that perspective to the role.
Yeah. So I want to get something out of the way because I don't want to sit here and put all of my frustrations about Bob Ferguson on you. Sure. I don't think that's inherently fair, but I do think that you
think
have, I think you have a little bit to answer to because you made the mistake of suggesting or saying that Bob Ferguson has a wonderful legacy that you want to build upon.
I think great legacy.
Great,
I think.
Yeah. Wonderful, whichever word. You stand by that? He has a great legacy in the AG's office?
Yeah, let me say a few things.
Please do.
I think there are, at least from my perspective, unquestionably positive things that Bob and his team have done over the last 12 years. You know, 12 years ago, there was not a civil rights division in the AG's office. Mm-hmm. I think it was outstanding. They created and built that work and have done outstanding work in that field. 12 years ago, there was not an environmental enforcement protection division where we have, as a state, aggressively gone after people who are causing harm to our environment. I think from my perspective, he's been a real champion around consumer advocacy and representing people in that role. Bob and I are very different people. We have very different backgrounds. I know the office will be different under my leadership, but as I look back at some of the wins they've had and the successes, I think there's been some great stuff that's happened there. I think there's been great stuff over the history of our AG's office going back. You know, I look, AG Rob McKinnon and I disagreed about a lot of things, but I think there's some really positive things there. Same with Governor Gregoire, former AG Gregoire.
Yeah.
But I like a lot of what Bob's done. It's not perfect. It's not exactly how I would have done things, but yeah, I think there's a lot of positive.
Well, I want to talk about that then, because I think we have a lot of independent viewers. So if there's a line to be drawn, I want to give you an opportunity to draw it.
Sure.
Because again, I haven't been not secretive about how I feel about Governor Inslee and the job that he's done or Bob Ferguson, both of whom have endorsed you. So with Bob Ferguson, one of my fundamental complaints, and I think for a lot of people, is this feeling as if he has turned that office into a machine to weaponize against political opponents. So, for example, he has talked endlessly about his lawsuits against Donald Trump, and he'll always sort of couch it, well, nobody complained when I twice sued the Obama administration. It's like his go-to line. Well, two times isn't, you know, 20 plus times, and it isn't something that absorbed four entire years of his time in office. Do you believe he spent too much time suing Donald Trump?
No, I don't. And I think if we step back from the macro and look at each of those individual cases, I don't know if there's a case that he brought against Donald Trump that I wouldn't have brought. I'm not familiar intimately with all of them, wasn't in the room to make those decisions. And sometimes I hear the general public or independent viewer say, you know, he shouldn't have sued Trump as much. And then you say, well, which case shouldn't they have brought? And people have a harder time answering that question. And again, I'm not intimately familiar with all the cases mm-hmm. that were brought against the Trump administration. But the ones I'm familiar with, I don't know. I think I would have made the same decision to bring those cases. You know, I've been around as a lawyer long enough to know that it's hard to sit on the outside and say they made this mistake or I wouldn't have done that, having not reviewed the evidence or the case file or talked to a team about it. But at the macro level, sure, I think bringing those cases was in the best interest of Washington, and they did a good job. They were successful, which also means that for the most part, courts agreed with the cases that were brought.
Yeah. I think there's a perception, though, for instance, if Bob Ferguson's the governor and Donald Trump wins the presidency, is that going to ultimately harm the state of Washington? If we've got an AG who doesn't like Trump, we've got a governor who spent 4 years suing Donald Trump, and we've got Donald Trump who can be a very petty man making decisions about what can impact
well,
the state
Bob's
of Washington.
Fault, right?
Well, Bob's a petty man too, so that's well, not, he's like, why did I come?
No.
But can you focus on, we have so many challenges in the state of Washington. Yeah. That's my concern. It's like, the state of Washington is not better off than it was 12 years ago, period. I fundamentally disagree with that, especially from a public safety perspective. And, you know, you're running to be the state's chief law enforcer. So I worry that so much time is spent on Donald Trump and not enough time is spent on bettering the lives of Washingtonians.
Well, that assumes that the cases brought against the Trump administration weren't in the benefit of Washingtonians.
I think some of them were pretty far afield.
Well, like what?
Like border child separation. I think we have very few Washington families who were impacted by child separation. And I would also argue when it comes to travel bans and things like that. We have some, but I think far more Washingtonians are impacted by the fentanyl that's coming up from the southern border as a result of lax border security. And I didn't see Bob Ferguson suing to try to stop the flow of fentanyl into our country.
Well, again, having not sat in that position, I'm not sure what the decisions I would have brought in had I been AG over the last 12 years. But I do think as we look at the individual cases, people have a harder time saying, well, that was a case that shouldn't have been brought.
Yeah. How do you balance that, I guess? Nick Brown, Bob Ferguson aside, if you've got qualms with the federal government, be it under Harris or Trump, how do you balance that between something that, maybe it's like going to make a good political point or headline and, hey, I've got other stuff to do in Washington?
Well, a few different things come to mind. I hope that I have an office and an agency that can do multiple things at once. Mm-hmm. And obviously you can't do everything or at least do everything well. And so as a leader, you have to sort of prioritize in the moment what types of challenges that we're facing. But I think that team has shown, and I hope to have a team that can continue to do that good work on behalf of the people. I think you bring that same analysis regardless of who's president or is this in Washingtonians' interests? Do we have a legal argument to make? Are we the right venue to bring it? Sometimes it makes it appropriate for Washington to take the lead. Sometimes it's appropriate for a local jurisdiction or other state to take a lead. And I think that's really important. The other lens that I bring to it is that litigation is a very important tool. It's certainly not the only one. Mm-hmm. And I know having been the U.S. attorney, having sat in other leadership roles, that sometimes you can use that immense power that comes from offices like that to solve problems without a lawsuit. Sometimes it's the threat of a lawsuit. And oftentimes litigation is the only tool that you have. But I hope to be the AG that can be focused on driving that office towards problem solving. And that doesn't necessarily mean a lawsuit. That might mean, how do we convene people to problem solve, to data share, to do all these things, to write a new piece of legislation that are separate and apart from a lawsuit? Again, as a lawyer's office, litigation is the tool that we most think of. It is the most frequently used, but it's certainly not the only tool that we can use in that agency.
Yeah. What about police prosecutions? That's been another issue that I think for me personally has been a point of frustration. You've got the officers in Tacoma who the AG's office tried for murder. They were acquitted, and it almost felt like triple jeopardy for them, where it was like, cleared an internal and then no charges filed. And the governor's like, hey, I'm going to have the AG investigate this. And all of a sudden they're on trial for murder and their lives have been completely destroyed. As the AG, how will you determine what cases to bring about when it comes to use of force or crimes committed by law enforcement agencies?
Well, I've been a lawyer 22 years now, which makes me feel old as I say it. The vast majority of that time around public safety, criminal justice issues. You know, I started my legal career as an Army lawyer, as a criminal defense lawyer, representing soldiers in the Army. And then I became a prosecutor in the Army, 6 years roughly with the Department of Justice, and then as U.S. attorney. And so I've spent most of my career in and around these very complex, hard issues. we need to do a lot to increase public safety in Washington and nationally for that matter. I think one of the things that makes our community safer is trust and accountability in law enforcement as well. And I think we do the same thing like you would any other case. You know, I've investigated and prosecuted hundreds of cases. When I was U.S. attorney, every indictment had my name on it. It's responsibility I took very seriously. And what I would do with my team is sit down is, you know, analyze the facts, analyze the law, you know, say, can we prove this to a jury and then proceed? If we have an allegation of a crime by a law enforcement officer, you don't change that basic formula. Mm-hmm. You sit down with your team. Has a law been violated? Are we the right person to bring it? As you know, you can't bring a case currently criminally outside of a very small select series of cases unless a local prosecutor or the governor ask the AG to bring those cases. But there's no reason in my mind to treat that any differently. And I've worked with law enforcement for the vast majority of my career. I have tremendous respect for how hard and difficult that job is and how much that we ask for them. But if we think that they violated the law and we think we have the evidence to prove and convince a jury of that, then we should bring a case as a state, whether it's the AG's office or some other jurisdiction.
Do you believe that the prosecution of those Tacoma police officers was political?
No, I don't. Well, again, I didn't sit in that room. Mm-hmm. I didn't read the case file. I didn't talk to witnesses. You know, I certainly followed it as a citizen because I was U.S. attorney at the time. This was an issue that I paid more and more attention to. So from the outside, I didn't see anything that smacked me as pure politics about that case. Mm-hmm. You know, the AG is a political office, right? We elect this person. We entrust this person with a great deal of power. I think people often think the decisions made by politicians is purely political. I have tremendous respect for the people in that office, the vast majority of whom are totally apolitical career people who have been there for a long time. You know, Bob's the only elected person, and then he gets to point people into positions.
Yeah.
But at least from the outside, I didn't see anything that was political about it, other than the process of the case getting to him. It came from the governor, right? Who's mm-hmm. the chief executive of the state. And Bob is a politician elected to that office. So it's political inherently given their positions. But I didn't see anything from the outside that struck me as like, this was totally a politically driven position.
Yeah, it's tough because you are politicians, you know, and you run with a letter next to your name. And it comes with all the baggage that anything you've said and done in the past and how it might, in the eyes of the public, influence your decision making. Yeah. So I guess for officers who, and I hear it a lot, I mean, we have the lowest number of police officers per capita. There are some politicians who believe we could throw money at them and convince more people to do those jobs. But I think respect is part of it, but also a feeling that, hey, if we go out and do our jobs in good faith to the best of our ability, we're not going to wind up in front of a jury of our peers looking at life in prison. So what would your message be to law enforcement officers who genuinely are scared to do their jobs proactively because they're fearful of the potential political consequences?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let me just speak briefly about for me personally.
Yeah.
You know, early on in my campaign, I got a call from, I don't want to out them, but a call from someone who works with a leading law enforcement organization.
Yeah.
And he said to me, like, look, I'm happy to make connections for you, introduce mm-hmm. you to people in this field, people that you don't know. And he said, look, I want to be very clear. I'm not doing this because I agree with everything, but because we had worked on some very tough issues together when I served as governor's counsel. When I was governor's counsel, we were still dealing with body cameras as an emergent technology, new use of force policies, et cetera. And I was often in that space working with some law enforcement advocates, working with legislative members about this. And we often disagreed. And most of that community did not like my boss, Governor Inslee. Mm-hmm. But I always tried to push the ball up the hill and work respectfully. And so I'm really proud of my engagement in the past. And so I bring that experience. And as U.S. attorney, I was the chief federal law enforcement officer for Western Washington. And have worked with state and local and federal law enforcement officers for much of my career as an assistant U.S. attorney. And I think that gives me some credibility, despite the letter next to my name as a candidate mm-hmm. And as a politician. But what I would say to those officers, I'm going to bring that experience to bear. I have tremendous respect for the work that they do. And if they've done the right thing, we're not going to prosecute people. But if there's an allegation that they violated the law under Washington, and there's a request from the governor or a local prosecutor's office that we investigate, then I'm going to take that responsibility very seriously. because ultimately I do think it's important for the public to believe and to have some confidence that law enforcement officers are not unaccountable. And there's certainly that perspective in the community as well. But I bring a lot of experience having led complicated investigations, having looked at these issues very seriously. And that's not going to change for me as Attorney General.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to what the public believes is in your heart, right? And the, yeah, the record of it does, you know,
yeah,
and it's
right.
Like for, and I'll just say again, I'm not trying to, yes, I am, to criticize Bob Ferguson, but you know, it drives, and he's probably never going to speak to you again for coming in. It drives me nuts that, you know, he's labeled himself this public safety candidate. There's so many examples over the last 12 years that law enforcement could have used a little like, hey, we've got your back from the state's chief law enforcer and just didn't get it. You know, when the cars were burning in downtown Seattle, when CHOP happened, when the defund the police movement was going on, I mean, it was silence from the AG's office, no stance, no pushback, nothing. And so there's a track record there where people have a feeling that he doesn't like law enforcement. So from your perspective, throughout your career, are there things for law enforcement officers who are watching or people who are concerned with public safety that you have done when the moment demanded that you say something or do something? Have you stuck up for them in the past? Do you have a track record of looking out for their interests and having their back?
Well, first, I think Bob's going to have to speak to me because he's going to be my client. So I anticipate having a lot of conversations.
Agree to disagree, but yeah. Okay, great. Gotcha.
This is the first time I've run for public office.
Yeah.
So I haven't been in those positions where the public may have seen me advocating for anything, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as governor's counsel, I was more public than your average lawyer. As U.S. attorney, I was super public. And again, I think if people look at my record, if they talk to anyone in the law enforcement community who's ever worked with me,
mm-hmm.
Oftentimes those agents and officers that I worked with disagreed with me. But I don't think any of them felt like I disrespected them, that I didn't value their work, that I didn't understand how hard it was to be in those positions. And I would continually push them on things as well, about being more accountable, about engaging with the community in a better way, about how we solve these problems. And, you know, we're really divided on law enforcement issues in particular, into these corners about us versus them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard. And people feel it genuinely, as you've indicated. But I think of my record as 22 years a lawyer, 15 or so directly doing criminal work. It's a pretty strong record of working collaboratively with law enforcement. You know, your average voter is not going to know that. Your average law enforcement officer in Washington State doesn't have that personal relationship. But I think if they talk to people who have worked with me, they'll find that it was always respectful, that I stood, you know, had their back on many tough issues. You know, I've been in that room as a U.S. attorney trying to deliberate about how we're going to bring a case, and agencies really pushing for something. And sometimes my prosecutor is being like, well, I'm not really sure that's the right thing. And I always approach those decisions with, you know, utmost seriousness. So that's what I can offer to people. Again, it's been mostly behind the scenes given my roles, but I don't think you're going to find anybody who I've worked with who's going to say something, you know, different or dramatically different.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things you've said on the campaign trail I want to ask you about. But do you believe fundamentally it's the job of the Attorney General to weigh in on issues related to public safety? Because we mentioned earlier, right, you're not, you know, directly responsible, so to speak, for homicides increasing, for robbery, whatever it is. But you are the state's chief law enforcer. So if you're put in that role and we have issues with public safety in the state of Washington, be it an increase in homicide or gang activity or stolen vehicles, do you see yourself weighing in publicly on those things?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot that could fall under that umbrella.
I'll give you an example. I'll give you an
example.
2021, in the legislature, they rolled back police pursuits. It became a hot topic for the next 3 years. Of course, there was a successful initiative. The current attorney general opted not to say anything about that, although he came out this year and said, I never supported the rollback in police pursuits. Yeah, great timing. Is that something where if you felt as the attorney general, it wasn't in the best interest of public safety, a law that's being pushed in Olympia, would you say so?
I think so. And my sort of deliberation about that is twofold. One, part of the job of the AG as well is to make sure that you're working with your legislature as a client as well,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that they're crafting the best policies, to give them candid advice about the legality, the how efficient or effective this law is going to be. I know I'll bring a lot of experience to that work moving forward, and I do foresee a very active role engaging with the legislature on these issues in particular. And so I want to make sure that as I'm doing that work, I'm not saying something publicly that's at odds or in conflict or divides any sort of confidences that I've given to my legislative clients as well. But I think on large issues of public import, and I would put mm-hmm. what you've categorized into that type, I certainly envision being engaged. It's hard to predict every issue that'll come down the pipeline during the next 4 years. But I think there have been many issues where it would be very important for the AG, the governor, other state leaders to speak up and to engage and to explain also to the public. And part of the challenges that I think we've seen is that there's often a misunderstanding about legal issues or public safety mm-hmm. issues. And I think the AG should be really actively involved in that space. And I do fundamentally believe that in addition to what we've been speaking about, law enforcement and accountability, the things that make safety sustainable, the AG should have a leading role. And to me, it's all the underlying things, housing, jobs, an education system, all those things play a really important role in public safety as well. And I don't think we talk enough about those issues either.
Yeah, because what the AG says or doesn't say can be significant. I mean, I think there have been some times in the last 5 years where had the governor said something, had the AG said something, two of the most prominent Democrats in the state, I think that their party maybe would have taken pause and said, okay, maybe we should reevaluate.
Like, because everybody listens to the governor.
Well, but let's be honest. I mean, in maybe even more so Bob Ferguson, during police defunding, had Bob Ferguson come out and said, hey, guys, that's not the way to do this. I believe it would have had some sort of impact, certainly in Seattle. So if I can go through a couple issues with you to see where you're at, the level of support, did you support police defunding?
No.
And you don't support police defunding today?
No.
Did you ever come out and say you didn't support police defunding or have an opportunity to say so?
I don't think I weighed in publicly on any of that. I mean, when police defunding first came up, I was still a partner at a law firm, so it wasn't really in my purview. And certainly as U.S. attorney, as U.S. attorney, it's a political process to become the U.S. attorney, but the DOJ takes its apoliticalness very, very mm-hmm. seriously, so it would never have been appropriate for me to weigh in on anything that might be considered political. But I've never been an advocate nor done anything in support of defunding.
What about drug decriminalization?
I have never supported that.
And you've never supported it, you would never support it or advocate for drug decriminalization?
Well, to say never, ever under any circumstances, I'm not going to commit to that. I did not support the recent efforts that were floating about in the legislature. I was happy that they found a way to reach a solution around criminalizing it with gross to misdemeanors for possession. I do not think decriminalization as a policy matter is right for Washington, certainly not right now. But our perceptions on public safety issues change dramatically over time. And how we think about crime and safety and accountability now versus 30 years now is markedly different. In some ways, I think better, in some ways, maybe not. 5 years from now, if there's a question about that, but I have never supported decriminalization. Mm-hmm. I've prosecuted probably over 100 different people for drug trafficking. The vast majority of the casework as U.S. attorney was going after fentanyl traffickers, principally Mexican-based drug cartels, but also a lot of homegrown people here in Washington. So that has never been something that I've advocated for.
Yeah, it doesn't really freak me out if somebody changes their views over the course of 30 years. I mean, I voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So
good for you.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really, really proud of that vote. What does freak me out is when they change their views so dramatically over the course of 3 or 4 years. I mean, police defunding was 4 years ago. Bob Ferguson saying he supported drug decriminalization was 3 years ago. And now, people take a totally different approach, and they tend to do that when they're running for an office where they think moderating their views is going to be somehow beneficial to them. So when it comes to that, I mean, I know you can't promise people like, hey, I'm not going to shed an exoskeleton and be a completely different person as attorney general, but is what you're selling us what we're going to get from you?
Well, there's 100 different issues we could talk about.
Yeah.
With respect to drug decriminalization specifically, I've never supported it in the past. I cannot envision a time in the next few years of having a different perception on that.
Yeah.
So at least, as my first term as attorney general, should I succeed in next month, which is crazy that it's next month all of a sudden, I don't envision taking a different position on that.
On the, because you mentioned policy is one of the kind of things that's going to be important as attorney general if you're elected, your possible predecessor. He has made gun control a pretty significant part of his time in office and something he's advocated the legislature for. Do you support some of the policies he pushed for that are now law, like a ban on so-called semi-automatic assault weapons?
Absolutely.
You believe it's constitutional?
Well, every court has also believed that.
So you do believe it? Well, I don't know if some of these are a done deal, but the
high-capacity
magazines, you Absolutely. Support that? You yeah. believe it's constitutional?
Yes, I do.
Should we expect that you will seek to introduce more gun control policies while AG?
I hope to be a partner in that effort. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's AG request legislation, I'm not sure. I don't want to start working on policy requests mm-hmm. when I'm not in that position yet. But let me just step back. I mean, I think gun violence is one of the most serious problems that we have in Washington, in America. And in under the violence umbrella, I put both crimes of violence, but also suicides, which, as you know, is the number one cause of firearm death mm-hmm. in Washington and America. I think the gun safety measures that we've passed in Washington are the steps in the right direction. None of them have been overturned to date, and I would foresee us being able to defend their constitutionality. And I think they actually save lives. And, you know, let me highlight one thing, because guns may be more than everything. Maybe other than abortion, are some of the most divisive and political issues for mm-hmm. people. You know, Washington, during the COVID era, almost every state in the country saw an increase in suicide by firearm. Washington was the only exception in the country. We reduced suicide firearm deaths by about 6%. There are a lot of different reasons that I think contribute to that. But I am pretty confident that part of the reason for that success with some of the gun safety laws that we passed.
Nobody's killing themselves with a semi-automatic assault.
But extreme risk protection orders, yeah. which gun advocates opposed aggressively, which allows people to temporarily have their weapons taken from them when they're a risk to themselves or others. Again, strongly opposed by the gun lobby as unconstitutional, unsuccessfully. Safe storage requirements, which requires people to keep mm-hmm. their firearms stored safely. Those things, I think, and the evidence has shown, save lives. So during this period of time, we've literally saved hundreds of lives because of gun safety measures. I think those are things that we should strive for. And if there are new measures that Washington should pursue that we can do constitutionally under the mm-hmm. Second Amendment to help save lives, that's something that I believe in.
But you do know that gun crimes are up and gun homicides committed with a gun have more than doubled in the last 12 years in our state. So we have more gun control efforts and laws yeah. than we've ever had before.
We also have more guns than ever yeah. before.
But that's a point, right? When yeah. you're saying we ban this, ban that, there's still more guns on the street than ever before. There's still more gun homicides in our state than we've had at least in the last 15 years. More incidents of shots fired, despite the fact that we had the ban on high-capacity magazines, yeah. yet the round per instance is way up. So if these gun control laws are so great, why has it not helped?
Well, first of all, no single law is a perfect solution for any crime and justice issue. And just as a citizen, part of the frustration I have mm-hmm. sometimes with politicians is when they talk about public safety issues, and this is nonpartisan mm-hmm. or bipartisan. If we just do this, we're going to solve crime, we're going to reduce crime. Crime, more than almost any other public policy issue, is so complicated and layered. Frankly, the number one thing we should do to reduce crime is invest in early childhood education, because it does a lot of good. There's a lot of data that shows that. So the idea that one gun law is going to change dramatically all of these things, I think, is just a little bit Pollyannish. But I do think that they reduce the likelihood of certain types of violence, that they make us safer.
They haven't made us safer, though, Nick. But we're less safe.
Right, but for a variety of other reasons as well. So I don't know. So if we didn't have these gun safety laws, I think we would have higher numbers. It's hard to study these things, but I'm a firm believer that gun safety measures do more public good than harm.
Yeah, well, and I think, so look, I'm not a Second Amendment person, right? I love the Constitution. So it always...
More a First Amendment
person. It's right. And so I get fearful. And the reason why I defend the Second Amendment is because I believe a government that would erode or challenge our protections under one amendment would be a government that would be emboldened to challenge other aspects of our protections under the Constitution. And like you said, I make a living off the First Amendment. So I'll defend the Second just as fervently as I'll defend the First. You said something, and I'll tie these two things together. So you said something that your opponent tried to ding you for. And I actually agreed with you on my show. I don't know if you saw this segment.
I haven't watched.
You said, I'm sure you'll give the, you give me the better quote, something about not sentencing people to more time than is needed to keep the public safe. Do you recall the, yeah, what is the full quote?
That we should not advocate for sentences longer than we think is necessary.
Yeah, and Pete Serrano put that out as some like outlandish thing. And I said, well, I agree with him. I don't want a government that's going to just like, for the sake of it, be like life in prison, you know, for. So I agree with you that sentiment in principle for the sure. same reasons, I think. But in practice, I don't think that that's happening. I don't think that we're seeing our courts that are giving people sentences commensurate with the crimes they're committing. And I'll bring that back to guns, and maybe it can frame our conversation, what you said based on guns. So if we were throwing the book at gun offenders, if we weren't giving them plea deals, if we weren't actively pleading away mandatory firearm enhancements of 5 years, which we've seen repeatedly over and over in the courts, and we were holding people who actually commit crimes with guns accountable, I don't think I would be as upset about saying, okay, what else can we do? Like, we're doing everything we can to hold people accountable for the crimes they commit with a firearm. Now on the back end, that's not enough. So what can we do in safe storage and background checks and all of that? So that's where I have an issue with this, just this entire conversation and the approach of let's ban semi-automatic assault weapons and safe storage and all of this. It's like, do you think we're doing enough and the courts are doing enough to give people sentences that are lengthy enough and appropriate to protect them from the public and to dissuade them from committing future gun crimes?
Well, for, let me step back a little bit, because I did think you adequately quoted me with the necessary language. And, you know, frankly, I was, I'm not surprised, but a little bit baffled when Pete tried to make a big deal of that. And because, well, one, he had started by misquoting me, but two, he's never done any criminal work as far as I know in his career. And so it was a little bit like armchair quarterback on some of these issues. But I do think fundamentally we should be encouraging prosecutors and judges for that matter, but I've only been a prosecutor, to push for sentences that we think are necessary to keep us safe. And that is a informed position that comes with analyzing that individual case, talking to the law enforcement officers involved, talking to the victims, if there are any involved, thinking about what that person's history is, what's actually going to increase safety moving forward. I know, having been a federal prosecutor for many years, that our laws sometimes allow for a huge range of possible sentences for someone.
Sure,
right?
Do.
Yeah, they really do. Particularly in the federal system, which is, you know, the sentencing guidelines. So there are sometimes when I was an AUSA or when I was U.S. attorney, where we could have asked for the statutory maximum of 30 years. But then you do that individual analysis and you say, actually, we think what is necessary here is 8 years. Or whatever, 12 years, 15 years, something less than the maximum. I never would think it was appropriate use of our resources or really increasing public safety to go for that maximum simply because you could, which is why I said we should ask for what is necessary to keep the community safe, to increase the likelihood that this person doesn't reoffend again, et cetera. Also with the recognition that, you know, 97% or something of people that we send to prison are going to get out one day. And we should be really focused on how do we prevent them from going there in the first place? And how do we help them from getting back when they come back into the community? I do believe that most people are redeemable or at least deserve the opportunity to show redemption. And I can't speak for every county or judge or case. I'm sure having looked at some of these cases that have made the headlines that have been upsetting to you or others, that in some of those circumstances, I would have advocated for more in prison or jail and maybe some less. Yeah. I can't speak for all those cases. But there's a, it, you know, it's a hard balance sometimes. You know, there are some times where, and I've talked to some judges about this, federal judges, where over years of trying cases and seeing cases, they started to see diminishing returns of success, right? So particularly in the drug space, where we could go in and ask for those real harsh maximums, where we had done that more in the past, where, and I remember a very distinct conversation with a judge who communicated to me that they had started to see that that actually started to be less effective, that after 7 years, you get diminishing returns from the longer punishment. Sometimes it's absolutely necessary. But I want to be mindful of the fact that eventually these people are going to get out and we need to try to make sure that they are less likely to commit crimes. And that's just hard. So in some of those cases, I'm sure I would have advocated for more, but I don't know collectively if it's easy to divide those into simple solutions.
Yeah, and I know it's far afield from what your job would be as AG, but I think it speaks to the mindset. And if you're in you're supportive of some of these gun control measures, I think, you know, for instance, we had this case in Tacoma where this young girl moved across the country with her boyfriend, broke up with him, moved back, followed her across the country, came into her house, shot her in the back of the head and killed her. And prosecutors end up giving him a plea deal where he'd spend like 5 years in prison. And they dropped as part of that plea deal the mandatory firearm enhancement, which would have been 5 years, no good time allowed, hard time. And so we see something like that. And I've seen repeated cases like that. And we've got, you know, the AG and Democrats in Olympia saying gun control, gun control, gun control. Well, the laws we have aren't being utilized to their fullest effect. So that's, I guess, when I have a hard time getting behind new gun control, when the gun laws designed to punish criminals who use guns are so freely, you know, bargained away.
Yeah, I guess I don't always think about those in the same sort of connection that you're making. The other thing I'll say, and, you know, so the situation, I mean, I know the headline from the case you're talking about. I don't know much more beyond that. It's obviously just reading the stories about it.
Yeah.
Incredibly frustrating, angering, and scary. But I don't know anything about the details of that case. And I will tell you, having managed my own caseload, having overseen hundreds of indictments as the U.S. attorney, there are some times where you make those decisions where you're doing it based on how strong is our evidence, right? Mm-hmm. So if we think we're going to lose this case, are we cutting someone a deal because we want to get something?
He confessed.
Well, I don't know about that case.
Yeah.
But I know that happens, right? Mm-hmm. That you're pushing for a resolution. Sometimes you have victims who come to you and say, I don't want my family to sit through years of trial and wait. I'd rather just get certainty now. And again, every case is different. When we see someone who is an obvious danger who then continues to commit harm, I keep hitting this microphone. Sorry, Nicole.
You're fine.
You know, that's aggravating. But I also just know from years of experience that sometimes those aren't as simple as just reading the headlines.
Yeah. Well, I want that to be in your mind. If you become AG and you're, you know,
I like
pushing.
I said, when if. We're going to speak it into existence.
Pete's going to be like, did you say when? When if? Because again, if the goal is to reduce gun violence and we're pushing these gun control laws, and they're not, they're not reducing gun violence. They're not reducing the number of guns on the street. All they're doing is regulating law abiding gun owners. And then the people who use guns to commit crimes are just literally having a free for all with it. There are some things that have been proposed, and even one thing that passed this legislative session, where I believe the intent is to render the Second Amendment useless. As an example, because I'm curious from a constitutional basis whether this is something you'll support, defend, or pursue. There was a law this past legislative session that added all of these cumbersome requirements onto firearm shops, where it's, you know, it's a bunch of storage. You have to store video. You have to put video cameras up in certain locations. You've got to harden your doors. And all these security requirements, increased insurance requirements. There's gun shops who said, well, we just have to close because now we cannot afford to be in business to sell firearms. There is an internal email that was leaked from a Democratic lawmaker, and one of the proposals she wanted is to ban the sale of ammunition. Ban the sale of ammunition. Do you believe it would be constant? And I believe they'll resuscitate that. Do you believe banning the sale of ammunition in Washington state would be constitutional?
Well, let me say two things. One, I haven't read the bill.
Yeah.
Two, I don't think so.
Because it would render the Second Amendment useless, right? If you can't buy ammunition.
It's hard for me to see the United States Supreme Court finding that constitutional. Mm-hmm. Again, having not read the bill, I don't know exactly what the language or limitations would
be. It was an internal email of deliberations where they
wasn't an actual bill.
They had not drafted it. But again, it's in there with lawmakers in the Democratic caucus talking about possible gun control legislation.
I don't want to speculate about a bill that even hasn't been drafted. But I it's hard for me to imagine a court upholding that, again, with all sorts of caveats. Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you about your time with Governor Inslee, because I want to ask you about power and about the concentration of power. When did you leave the governor's office?
2017.
So before the pandemic?
Well before.
Do you believe that the governor outstretched his executive powers during the pandemic? And don't tell me you don't know, because I know you were watching. You have an opinion on it.
Outstretched.
Do you believe that he abused?
Violated some law?
Do you believe he abused his emergency powers?
No.
You don't. 975 days of one man rule.
Has any court found it that he abused it?
Well, no, but do you believe...
Has anybody lawsuit been filed that he abused it?
There's legally speaking, do you believe that a governor should utilize emergency powers for 975 days?
If the governor determines that the situation requires it, sure.
So you would be okay with that as an AG, independently elected official for any state of emergency situation?
No. You can't just say all these hypotheticals.
But you're saying as long as a governor finds that it's appropriate. Right.
Well, let me just step it back to what actually happened with respect to COVID.
Sure.
I think what the governor and many state and local officials did saved lives here in Washington. Mm. I also recognize we were dealing with an unprecedented public health emergency. We were the first state in the country to start shutting down because of the early cases that happened here. And what, we lost 15,000 or so lives in Washington related to COVID. I think we would have lost more had we been less stringent with our laws. Now, sitting here in 2024, almost 2025, are there things that I think I would have done differently had I sat in that chair? Yeah, maybe.
Like what?
Oh, you know, I mean, I had two young kids. The schools were closed for a long time. I think in hindsight, we probably could have opened the schools earlier. Mm-hmm. But I also wasn't sitting in that chair in the governor's office faced with more information than I have as Joe Citizen and trying to make these really tough decisions and also decisions that can't be necessarily nuanced to every individual or every individual family. Mm-hmm. So I have a tremendous respect for how hard that was. I do think ultimately it saved lives. Undoubtedly, I think we could have probably done some things different. But to your initial question, was it illegal or improper? Mm-hmm. Nothing that I've seen that suggests that it was violating some law or some emergency powers. And as far as I know, no court has found that. And I am a lawyer, not to give you a whole legal answer, but I'm a lawyer aspiring to be the state's lawyer. So that's certainly the viewpoint and perspective that I start with.
Yeah, I think there's illegal and there's improper, right? I'm not saying it was illegal. I believe it was an improper abuse of power, only because you have... And I know that there was a bipartisan effort at some point to change it, right? I wish they would do that and go in and change the Emergency Powers Clause. But I guess it comes back to where I started the conversation about, as AG, if you feel like one of your clients is doing something that you don't agree with, as an example, the vaccine mandate, you know, and I agree with you that we can sit here and be like, oh, this and this during the pandemic was absurd. And hindsight is 2020, but there were some things that became very clear a year and a half into the pandemic, like the vaccines.
Very clear from our perspective sitting here.
Very clear from anyone's perspective.
Well, not anyone, because clearly most of the state leaders disagree with you.
Well, I think that they knew it was wrong, but they didn't want to admit they were wrong on the vaccine mandate, as an example.
But why are you assuming that?
Because you can't not. Let me give you an example.
I don't assume that. So
I will give you an example. Ahead. On the vaccine mandate, because the governor walked back part of it. So he puts down a mandate for state workers, get the vax or lose your job. And that was during a time when I got the vaccine. We were told that, hey, this is going to be our path out of the pandemic. If you want this nightmare to come to an end, get the vaccine. And I did it, like a lot of people.
Sure.
A lot of state workers did it in order to keep their job. And then it became very clear that the vaccine was not going to be as effective in stopping the spread of the virus. It just wasn't what we hoped it would be. Even the CDC acknowledged, like, yeah, it went from you're not going to get it or spread it to, yeah, you might not get as sick, but you can still spread it and you can still get it. It took a year to a year and a half after that for the governor to let up on his vaccine mandate. We still have state workers today who are out of a job, were never rehired when they lost their jobs under a mandate that didn't make sense for a long time. I mean, I'm not asking you to say whether you agree with the mandate or not, but if there is an instance where you as Attorney General believe that the governor or a state agency is doing something improper, can you take action? What do you do?
Well, I think on that issue and frankly many others, it sort of gets back to our earlier conversation. Mm-hmm. Your obligation is to advise your client to the best of your judgment and in their best interest. And so I know there was tons of conversations about what is lawful, what is in the best public interest, what are the extent of the emergency powers, et cetera. I assume all that was happening, having been the governor's counsel and knowing the governor. I know all that was happening. In that circumstance, that would be part of the AG's job and the AG's team to provide that advice and guidance. It would be, at least in my judgment, unethical as a lawyer to be advising your client of A, B, and C, and then go out into the public and say, my client's doing all the wrong things, if that was what your judgment was.
Right.
So sometimes you just keep your mouth shut about that, or you elevate it beyond the specific legal issue that you might be facing. But in no circumstance as a lawyer, private practice, criminal lawyer, government lawyer, should you say anything publicly that is undercutting your representation of your client?
But you think you could be the, you could tell Bob like, hey, what you're doing is don't do it.
Oh, I've told a lot of clients that.
Have you told Bob Ferguson that?
He's never been my client. Not directly.
Do you feel?
I've been an assistant attorney general, so in like some ways, I guess.
You're an independently elected official. Should people be confident that you're willing to go against Bob if you think it's in the best interest of the state?
Absolutely. Look, I had some, without divulging privilege, I had some hard-fought conversations with Governor Inslee as his lawyer.
Okay.
That was my job.
You don't want to share any of them?
No. Well, I do, but okay. I can't.
Gotcha. Okay.
And I've had clients in private practice where I've been like, this is not in your best interest. I don't think you should do this.
Yeah.
Ultimately, on ultimate case decisions, the client gets to decide certain things. I've had those tough conversations with my law enforcement partners. We shouldn't do this case or this type of investigation, or judges, like speaking back against judges. You know, when I was U.S. attorney, we had a case where we prosecuted a big cyber hacking case. It was the Capital One hack. $250 million in damage, $100 million, or people had their personal information. The judge gave them probation or supervised release. I thought it was a terrible sentence. And normally for U.S. attorneys, we don't comment. We comment on the victories. And I just put out a statement that said, this is not what justice looks like. And for a U.S. attorney to say that against a sitting federal judge was a very new experience for the judge and for my office. But it needed to be said because I thought it was not a just sentence. I thought it actually did not keep people safe, did not deter future hackers. Again, hundreds of millions of dollars in damage and 100 million people who had their personal information stolen. So I think of a long track record of speaking against powerful interests. You know, I know Bob and I will agree on a lot of things. I assume we'll disagree on other things, but it will be my job as in that role as the governor's lawyer, representing them fully. And sometimes that means telling them where you disagree.
You'll be able to work with Dave Reichert just fine though?
Sure.
Great.
I mean, I don't know Dave. I've actually never met him. But you know, my job will be to represent all of his cabinet agencies, while maintaining the independent authority to be an advocate for the people on other things.
Yeah. I want to ask about the initiatives. Do you support or oppose the initiatives on the ballot in November?
I oppose them.
You oppose all of them. So if there is legal action challenging the outcome of those, let's say they pass,
I will defend them.
How should we believe that you're going to defend them if you oppose them?
Because that's the job of the lawyer for the state of Washington. This is actually something where Pete and I have real fundamental disagreements. Pete, my opponent, who has said in various contexts that he won't defend things that he has independently determined are unconstitutional. If the people of the state of Washington pass that, or any of those initiatives, one or all four, they become the law of the land. It is the job of the attorney general to defend the law of the state. And that's what I will do to the best of my interest. Or best of my ability.
I've got to just point it out. Your campaign manager who's sitting behind you.
He's not my manager, but go ahead.
What's your job, Sandeep?
I'm a consultant.
Your campaign consultant who's in the room with us, he is one of the main people pushing the No on the Initiative campaign. He's one of the main people behind trying to defeat the initiatives. He's running your campaign.
He's not running my campaign.
Well,
he's part of the team.
Consulting with,
he helps.
He's here with you. He's consulting with your campaign. I'm sorry to put him on blast.
He's a proud member of my team. But
again, you can see my thought process of he opposes the initiatives. His consultant is trying to defeat the initiatives. And you're telling me if we pass them, you're going to defend them.
You've been around this for long enough.
I have. And I've also been around a lot of shady shit.
But look.
For the record.
I know. You don't think he's shady.
I adore Sandeep. Even though he's opposing the initiatives, we have a good laugh about it. He's a good guy. I think he's above board. I do have some stuff to say about him after the show, but okay, go ahead.
It is the job of the Attorney General to defend Washington state law.
Yeah.
I will not abdicate my job simply because I might disagree with it.
So you don't think it would be proper for you to maybe put it to someone else?
No.
Okay.
I mean, look, I've I've been a prosecutor, I've been a defense lawyer, I've done private practice, I've argued multiple cases in the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, I've done a ton of jury trials, which I don't think Pete has ever done. I know what it's like to be an advocate. I've gone into court and argued things that were in my client's interest. And that's the job of being the attorney general when it comes to laws passed by the people or by the legislature.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I can't do anything other than take you at your word.
Sure.
Because they are going to pass.
Well, look at that. We made news here.
And
they're
your
passing.
Own consultant will probably lead the lawsuits to challenge them. Well, we already have a steak dinner on the initiatives, which are going to pass. But it's, you know, people get, just as an example, the current, and I know we're way over time, so cut me off if we're going too long, but, you know, the current attorney general, there was a lawsuit filed that would have derailed the initiatives. The attorney general's office, no one even informed Let's Go Washington about it. They said you should have looked at the public court dockets.
But then he went to court and defended them, right? And
well,
he defeated
did.
Sandeep and his allies.
But imagine if he hadn't won, and here the people who pushed the initiatives didn't even know about it. Totally blindsided by it.
I'm not involved in that case, so I don't know why they were blindsided or whether they should have been paying closer attention themselves.
Yeah.
But I do know that Bob went to court and successfully defended them and defeated the people that were apparently counter to that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go over time too. Now. I remember early on when I was working for Governor Inslee.
Yeah.
And this was a real sort of wake up call for me. We had done something. The governor had done some advocacy, some work or something that was something that some of the labor unions supported in Olympia. And I remember reading about it sometime in the shortly thereafter. And there was a couple of reporters saying, well, the governor is appeasing his labor friends because he owes them, basically, was sort of summary. And I just remember being so angry because I had sat in that room as we were making the decisions and politics never came into it. Appeasing your friends or cashing in on campaign promises never came into it. I think it just got to what the governor fundamentally believed in his core. Now, I'm not politics comes into a lot of these decisions, but it doesn't always shape everything that we do in office. And I believe Republicans and Democrats who decide to go work in Olympia, I believe most of them come there with good intentions and they want to do the right thing. There have been some Republicans that I worked with in the legislature when I was counsel who I disagreed with on everything. But I did believe that most of them fundamentally believed that they were doing stuff to improve their community. Our ideas about what that improvement looked like was different. But I think sometimes because our politics is so divisive and so quick takes and you know, social media, that so often we just assume the worst intentions about people. And I experienced that as a candidate. You know, I try not to pay too much attention to what pops up in my Twitter feed, but the other day was somebody's like, oh, he's a communist. I was like, where, what about my resume strikes communist? Or there was another commentator who was actually a little bit more prominent conservative commentator who said, well, I have no doubt that Nick will be corrupted once he takes office. It's like, but what about me strikes corruption? I mean, maybe you may not like what I'm advocating for, but I think sometimes I wish people would just step back, not assume bad intentions, not assume people are going to do things solely because it's politics. You know, it's a hard battle to fight against, but that's my hope.
Yeah. Quick questions, and then we'll have you make your final pitch to undecided voters. Transparency is a big issue in the attorney general's office. They've been dinged a few times on discovery issues. They've been dinged on public records issues. How are you going? And one of the things that I understand, you know, there's a carve out in the law. So there's two separate issues here. Discovery, obviously, but then public records. You know, there's a carve out for legal advice, essentially, like legal working product. But man, we'll get records back. I remember this very well on the vaccine mandate and the legality of it. And you'll get 50, 60 pages of all black. And we will never know whether the things that were blacked out or are blacked out in those documents are truly justifiable redactions. So given that if you win, you're going to be coming into an office that the Seattle Times, the Coalition for Open Government, has been highly critical of for a lack of transparency. How do you fix that?
Well, I'm glad you pointed out that there are two distinct issues because sometimes discovery issues get looped in with public records issues and they're not totally unrelated, but they're different. I think the office on the discovery side should be continuing to try to improve its practices. They have a new a section of the office that's a discovery coordinator to help some of these practices. I think that's a positive direction. I know, having tried many cases myself and having overseen an office before, discovery issues are the things that keep people up at night, that they forgot or they missed something, and that they're going to be held accountable for it. But we have robust discovery for a reason. It's the best way to get as close to the truth as possible. And as a leader, my hope is to make sure that we continue to improve the discovery practices there. I know there were a couple cases they got dinged for, but I don't view those as systemic within the office.
Well, it wasn't just dinged. The judge called it huge penalties. He called it willful.
Huge penalties, but I think it was just only a couple cases. Mm-hmm. There's nothing I've seen from the outside that suggests that part is systemic. On the Public Records Act stuff, there's two different pieces of that as well. One is, how do we provide advice to local governments, to mm-hmm. the public? How do we use the Public Records Ombuds position to provide more resources? I think there's ways to strengthen that and provide more guidance, because I think it's been cut back a little bit mm-hmm. over the last part of years. And then there's how the office itself responds to public records requests. And having been the governor's counsel before, I know what it's like to fill out a public records request and provide it. And we should be redacting as little as possible or withholding as little as possible. But that just requires steady improvement. What I will say is, you know, when Governor Inslee campaigned first in the before the 2012 election, he made a commitment never to use the executive privilege. Mm-hmm. That had never been done before as a governor.
Yep.
And he never has.
And I've given him a lot of credit for that.
Well, it was my job to, at least for the first 4.5 years, to make sure that we stood by that. And we showed that we could function without it. So I think that we need to be very mindful about how we use some of those exemptions. I also sat on the Sunshine Committee, the Public Records Accountability mm-hmm. Committee, for many years, was always advocating for more transparency.
Which, like, wants to disband because they said that their work is, like, fruitless.
Well, it's been a while since I've been there, okay. But yeah, well, it was a frustrating committee to be on. But, you know, we need to have, it's one of the things I think that makes, you know, getting back to our earlier conversation, it's how we build more trust in government. Mm-hmm. We have big problems about lack of trust, about misinformation. The more that we can do, even outside of this context, by being more accessible to the public, by making our websites easier to use and operate, by providing more services to more people, the more we can reduce some of these challenges that we're facing.
Yeah, and I think that comes in practice. Like, will he be better than his predecessor when it comes to that stuff? And, you know, time will tell. One more issue before you make your pitch, the issue of sexually violent predators. Bob has lied about it. You can disagree with me. It's not really your job to disagree with me about it, but he's running.
Or agree with you about
it. He's running. Yeah, right. He's running ads saying, "Oh, I'm protecting communities from these people," completely ignoring the fact that they have been released at a very steady clip since he took office. I think they were averaging 1 to 2 releases from McNeil Island a year before he became the attorney general. Now, some years you have 50 or more releases into communities. Do you support closing McNeil Island?
Oh gosh, honestly, I haven't thought about that.
Okay.
I grew up in Steilacoom, Washington, with a view of McNeil Island.
There are some Democrats who want to close it.
Oh, I honestly have not contemplated whether we should close it or not. What's the right appropriate location for people who have committed those heinous crimes? I've prosecuted a ton of sexually violent predators in my lifetime. But I don't think it would be the job mm-hmm. of the Attorney General to make that decision ultimately. But honestly, I hadn't thought about it.
Well, it is the job of the Attorney General to make the decision about whether
to seek
civil commitment.
Right, but not about whether we maintain that facility or not, was the point I was making.
You would be a strong advocate. I mean, that the issue of relegating people to McNeil Island falls firmly in the Attorney General's office. So if Democrats in Olympia wanted to close it and advocated for closing it, do you know what side of that issue you'd sit on?
It doesn't matter to me where we house those people, or as long as we can do so in a safe environment. I have no concept of what the alternative people are talking about. I haven't been involved in those conversations. I know that that's such a unique class of people who mm-hmm. present a unique danger to people. And I guess I'm had not really thought of what another alternative would be.
Yeah.
But we need somewhere where we can put people who have committed those crimes.
Yeah. And it's a tough question to ask because, like, again, I'm a firm believer in the Constitution. Unfortunately, even though these are really sick and twisted individuals, we can't just put Americans on an island and say you can never get off. So they have a right to petition for release mm-hmm. from that island. But there have been a couple really scary instances where unconditional release has been granted by a court in the last few years. There was a woman who raped a baby who repeatedly said over and over that, you know, she was given partial, the conditional release in Lakewood. 1 month went by and she said she was looking at a 6-year-old out her window and thinking about molesting the 6-year-old. Well, within a year, she got unconditional release to Spokane because whoever the court appointed to sort of review it said, oh, well, we can't prove that she would commit another crime. And I'm thinking, she looked out a window at a six-year-old and thought of molesting them. Like, is that not ample evidence that she's still a predator? So how committed will your office be to trying to keep sexually violent predators on McNeil if you believe they're a risk to the community?
Well, if we've made that assessment that they continue to be a risk, and, you know, it's a risk both in the abstract, but also under Washington law, which has very specific contours. If we think they're a risk under Washington law, then we continue to advocate to detain them. You are right, of course. Everyone, the worst of the worst, have constitutional rights here in this country. Mm-hmm. We need to not disregard those without good reason. But if those risk factors are still present, then yes, we continue to advocate that they be held.
So you'll have many of the same attorneys. I assume there wouldn't be a lot of turnover between you and Bob Ferguson with the attorneys on your staff. So you're going to have attorneys who have been dealing with this issue. What should I make of the fact that 12 years ago, one or two were being released every year, and now more are being released than ever before?
Well, a couple of things. One, I can't sit here having no concept what those cases are. I also know, you know, there are times when I, as a prosecutor, when we had... so I was a gang coordinator for a couple of years. So the lead prosecutor on the federal side for prosecuting gang crimes. There were times in that tenure where we had a huge rash of pretty bad actors committing serious things, and then it decreased. I have no concept of what the caseload is, the factors. You know, I sort of default to trusting people's judgment, who have been doing this hard work. But I'm going to come in there and make sure that I have a good understanding of what past practices are, why decisions were made, and the like. But I have no concept of what each of those individual cases look like.
Yeah, well, we'll track them when you get in and see how many.
I'm sure you will.
Can you make a final pitch to voters who might still at this juncture be undecided?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when we're electing an attorney general, we're electing both a lawyer, a leader, and someone who shares our values. And, you know, I think if people take an honest assessment of my legal background and my leadership background, they'll feel confident that I'll be a good attorney general for them. As I've, you know, said, I've done a lot of different things as a lawyer, prosecuted tons of cases, defended cases, done complex civil work, done a lot of work that directly relates to the AG's office in trying cases in appellate court and in jury trials. Most of those things my opponent has never done. So if we just put politics aside for a second and talk about pure experience as a lawyer, I don't think our resumes compare. I think I'm a stronger candidate just on that. Leading the office is going to be a huge challenge. There's 800 plus lawyers, another 800 or so staff. It's an immensely big, heavy responsibility. And I think my background makes me uniquely qualified, not just being the U.S. attorney most recently, but all throughout my career, starting in the Army, when the very first supervision job I had was running the Free Army Income Tax Center, helping soldiers and their families do taxes. And I had a staff that I had to supervise, and I was a brand new butterball lieutenant. And progressively through my career, I've taken on these increasingly important leadership responsibilities. And again, I don't think my opponent can compete with that as a lawyer. And I think my values are more in line with where Washingtonians are at. You know, we're not going to make everybody happy. I'm a proud Democrat. I advocate for things I know not everyone who's watching this is going to agree with. But I'm always going to lead with ethics and try to do the right thing and try to benefit everybody in this community, including those who disagree with me. So that's my commitment to voters. And, you know, 1 month and 4 days till election day. Mm-hmm.
Well, we appreciate coming in. I know that, you know, maybe not the friendliest environment you can have, but I've watched your career over the years. I think if you win, I'm looking forward to seeing who Nick Brown is. I think you've worked under politicians, you know, whether you're a political appointee, under a governor. And I think there are obligations for people who, you know, serve in that kind of capacity. And so I would like to see, if you're elected, who Nick Brown is as his own sort of not under another politician.
I can assure you there'll be times where you agree with me and times that you do not.
Oh, I know. Do me a favor, though. If you and Bob Ferguson win and Bob Ferguson encourages you to give me the Tim Eymann treatment, can you intervene a little bit? Can you intervene?
You are and Tim Eymann are very different.
Well, I realize that. I also got you a gift. Is that allowed?
Sure. Just is it a campaign contribution?
To keep with you. Just a little copy of the little pocket constitution.
How do you know I don't have one?
You might. Yours doesn't have the notes that I put in this one. So I've made you, I put some notes in there. case you're ever sitting there wondering, am I doing the right thing?
Abridged
just
version.
Yeah, just flip through it, okay? There you go. Good luck to you, Nick.
I appreciate it.